Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Sunday, October the 29th, 2023. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. Later on, we'll be bringing you our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the ongoing devastating impact of the siege of Gaza by the Israeli Defense Forces backed up by the United States government. The system of oppression in Palestine has been compared to the former apartheid system in Southern Africa. We'll have details on that. Reports indicate that the number of casualties in Gaza have increased in the last 4 days. And we listened to an interview with the victims of the siege of Gaza. In the second hour, we review an interview with former United States State Department official Josh Paul, who recently resigned over differences with the President of the United States related to the question of arms shipments to the State of Israel. Also, an interview with the resistance forces of Hamas provides insights into the strategic outlook of the Palestinians. We examine the trauma suffered by children in the current onslaught in Gaza. And finally, we analyze the full spectrum of the blockade of the Gaza Strip. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude with the revolutionary voice and music of Egypt from Umm Kulthum and her orchestra. This is a concert recorded on February the 15th of 1968. Let's listen in.
Oh, وقد أريت deine بثمن معز بالمنادى لست أنساك وقد أغريتني بثمن معز بالمنادى ويد تمتد نحوي كيد من خلال الموج مدا لغريق وبريق يضمر الساري له أين في عينيك زياك البريد حبيبا زرت يوما أيكب طائر الشوق أغني ألمي حبيبا زرت يوما أيكب طائر الشوق أغني ألمي حبيبا زرت يوما هيكب طائر الشوق أغني ألمي لك إبطاء مسل المنعم وتجنب قادر محتكم وحنين لك يا قوي أضلعي وحنيني لك يا قوي أضلعي وحنيني لك يا قوي أضلعي والتواني جمرة طائر الشوق أغني ألمٍ لك إبقاء مجل منعم وسجن للقادر المحتكم وحنين لك يكوي الضياء وحنيني لك يكوي الضياء وحنيني لك يكوي الضياء والتوالي
من خيبي Thank you.
ساحر فيه عز وجلال وحياة. أين من عيني حبيب ساحر فيه عز وجلال وحياة. من عيني حبيب ساحر فيه عز وجلال وحياة. واثق كل خطوة يمشي ملكا واثق كل خطوة يمشي ملكا واثق الخطوة يمشي ملكا. ظالم
Yeah.
من عيني حبيب ساحر فيه عز وجلال وحياة واثق الخطوة يمشي ملكا ظالم
I'm صديق ونور
مطل كالحريق وإذا النور نذير طالع وإذا الفجر مطل كالحريق وإذا الدنيا كما وإذا الدنيا كما نعرفها وإذا الدنيا كما نعرفها وإذا الأحباب كل
فتعلم
Welcome back. And that was Umm Kulthum and her orchestra from a live concert in Cairo, Egypt, during February of 1968. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, October 29th, 2023. We are broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment. These are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. Recent events have demonstrated that Israel has completely failed in marginalizing or isolating Gaza. The importance of Gaza to the Palestinian struggle is neither economic nor political per se, but because, as Palestinian author and historian Ramzi Baroud put it, quote, it represents the heart of the Palestinian resistance, unquote. Baroud has repeatedly argued in the past that Gaza's power stems from its ability to disturb Israeli strategies, whether in Palestine or, as of late, in the entire Middle East. In a recent video, Baroud opined that, quote, tiny little Gaza, unquote, is perhaps the most important geopolitical entity in the Middle East and possibly the world right now. Below, the Palestine Chronicle provides some essential information about Gaza, which has managed to create some kind of a military balance against the once powerful Israeli army, a feat that has not been accomplished by several standing Arab armies combined. The history of Gaza spans four millennia. It was inhabited and ruled by many powers, destroyed and repopulated by various dynasties and empires, including the Egyptian pharaohs, Babylonians, Philistines, and Alexander the Great, who besieged and captured it after several major attempts in 332 BCE. The population of Gaza has inherited this legacy of resistance, which continues to this day. Rebuilt by the Romans, it was ruled starting in 637 CE by the Muslim general Amir ibn al-As, when most Gazans adopted Islam as their religion. The Crusaders tried to invade it in the 12th century, but were driven out by Salah al-Din Saladin. In the 16th century, it lived a golden age under Ottoman-appointed Ridwan dynasty. During World War I, it was captured by British forces. The population rapidly grew following the Nakba in 1948, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees were ethnically cleansed by Zionist militias following the establishment of Israel atop the ruins of historic Palestine. Gaza became the center of political activism during the First Intifada, the uprising of 1987. Following the signing of the Oslo Accord in 1993, it was put under the control of the newly established Palestinian Authority. In 2005, Israeli forces, which had occupied it since 1967, decided to redeploy, imposing a siege on the strip from all directions and from land, air, and sea. In 2007, the Palestinian movement Hamas won the democratic elections. Their win was not recognized by the United States or the State of Israel. It was then that Gaza was placed under even more hermetic siege, which also involved Egypt at the behest of Washington. Major Israeli wars and numerous other bombing campaigns were launched against Gaza, most notably in 2008, 2009, in 2012, in 2014, and in 2021, and most recently on October 7, 2023. Gaza is a very small territory that is home to over 2.3 million people. Is approximately 365 square kilometers in size. That's approximately 141 square miles. The Gaza Strip borders the Mediterranean Sea, Egypt, and Israel. It is situated on a relatively flat coastal plain. The climate is temperate. In Gaza, summers are long, warm, and arid, while winters are cool and mostly clear. Gaza has an extremely high population density of over 500 people per 100 square meters in some areas. The population is almost entirely Palestinian Arab. The vast majority of the population is Sunni Muslim, with a small Christian minority divided into the Orthodox and the Catholics. Children are nearly half of Gaza's population. So if you want to read this entire report, giving you some historical background on the Gaza Strip. Just go to the Pan-African News Wire. In other news, the U.S.-Israeli strategy of attempting to tie the destiny of the Arab world with Tel Aviv and to crush the idea of Palestinian resistance to occupation failed on October the 7th. There are some governments that are so cruel and unjust that people have no choice but to resist by force. After 16 years, the steel and concrete wall constructed by Israel to imprison Palestinians in Gaza was breached by Palestinian resistance forces on October the 7th. The current challenge is to break through the wall of U.S.-Israeli myths and lies that have been carefully constructed over the decades to maintain Israel's long history of oppression and injustice against the Palestinians, fabrications that have been used to sustain U.S.-Israeli hegemony in West Asia. 11 minutes after the Zionist leaders declared, without U.N. Security Council approval, quote, independence, on May the 14th, 1948, President Harry S. Truman became the first world leader to officially recognize the self-proclaimed Jewish state. The lies that began on that day have never ceased, nor has Palestinian resistance to the racist settler colonial state being built on their land. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And a victim, of course, are really regular right now in Gaza. Over 8,000 people have been killed. Tens of thousands have been injured and wounded. Well over a million people have been displaced. And others, all in fact, are suffering from lack of water, lack of food, medical attention, and peace. Palestinians in Gaza, now cut off from communication just 2 days ago with the rest of the world, were enduring another night of hell last night as Israel intensified its bombardments across the territory over the last 24 hours. Israel continued to intensely bomb the northern and eastern areas of the Gaza Strip late Saturday, particularly in Beit Hanun, while Palestinian resistance continued to fire rockets towards Israel, reaching as far as Tel Aviv and Ashkelon. The United Nations said on Saturday evening that fragmented information available indicates that the past 24 hours have witnessed the most intense Israeli airstrikes and artillery shelling since the military campaign began on October the 7th. The Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, said on Saturday that its forces hit an armored Israeli vehicle with an anti-tank missile east of al-Shujayyah near Gaza City. Qassam said his forces were repulsing the occupation ground forces in Gaza as Israeli leaders declared that the battle now in its third week is an existential one for the Jewish state in Palestine. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, made a declaration yesterday that many observers said demonstrated the intent to annihilate Palestinians not only in Gaza, but also in the West Bank and Israel. Netanyahu invoked scripture that calls for the total destruction of the enemy, sparing no man, woman, or child. Our brave troops and combatants who are now in Gaza, or Gaza and all other regions of Israel, are joining this chain of Jewish heroes, Netanyahu said. Netanyahu added that there are times a nation faces two options, to exist or to cease. We are now in such a test. He added that the war will be long and hard, and we are ready. It is our second war of independence. Palestinians and other observers interpreted that to mean a second Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and the dispossession of the homeland before, during, and after the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. And finally, the Hamas resistance organization has upended the status quo in Palestine. As Israel enters phase two of its attack on Gaza, there's much speculation as to what the Israeli military will face on the ground. The answer depends on the extent to which Hamas foresaw what Israel's response would be to the October 7th Operation Al-Aqsa flood. That in turn begs the question why Hamas did what it did when it did. Hamas officials had said they saw little choice but to act, having seen Palestinian aspirations to end Israel's occupation regress over the past decades. Amid international apathy, something had to change. We knocked on the door of reconciliation, and we weren't allowed in. Senior Hamas leader Musa Abu Mazouk told The New Yorker earlier this month. We knocked on the door of elections, and we were deprived of them. We knocked on the door of a political document for the whole world. We said, we want peace, but give us some of our rights. But they didn't let us in. We tried every path. We didn't find one political path to take us out of this morass and free us from occupation. Certainly, the background to the attack bears out Abu Mazouk's explanation. 75 years have, after being forcibly displaced from Palestine in 1948, 56 years of living under military occupation, 30 years of a peace process that has merely allowed Israel to consolidate its occupation in the West Bank, and 16 years of a Gaza blockade that has rendered normal life and a normal economy impossible there, generations of Palestinians have lived and died without any hope for a better future. The West's acquiescence with Israel's dangerous delusions that it could manage its occupation indefinitely has been equally instrumental in the current situation. With that, we'll conclude our Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we would like to remind our listeners, the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to this program, the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, October 29th, 2023, log on to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. That's Detroit's own Kim Weston with the track entitled Danger, Heartbreak Straight Ahead. And of course, there is danger to the people in Gaza who have been living through a nightmare over the last 3 weeks or more. That siege is intensifying by the State of Israel, the Israeli Defense Forces, the Israeli Air Forces, and of course, being backed up solely by the United States, the government in Washington, D.C. And of course, the entire region of West Asia and North Africa are imperiled by the intensified and expanded and perilous military presence by the United States in the Eastern Mediterranean. Just 2 weeks ago, Josh Paul, who was a high-level State Department official in charge of procurement of weapons for export, resigned from his position due to disagreements with the Biden administration over the stepped-up supply of military equipment, hardware, bombs, and other offensive weapons to the State of Israel amid the Al-Aqsa flood. Let's listen to an interview with Josh Paul.
There's simply an urgency to rush arms into a conflict where civilians are dying en masse. And that is what I don't understand. To get to negotiations requires trust and it requires leadership. Both are lacking right now on both sides, frankly. What we're ultimately talking about is the right of civilians, whether they be Palestinian or Israeli, to live in peace, to feel secure in their home, secure from rocket attack, and secure from F-16 drop precision-guided munitions.
Coming up on the Laura Flanders Show, the place where the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. Welcome. We cannot be both against occupation and for it. We cannot be both for freedom and against it. And we cannot be for a better world while contributing to one that is materially worse. So wrote today's guest in his letter of resignation from the U.S. State Department on October 18th. Josh Paul had served 11 years in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs, which is the U.S. government entity most responsible for the transfer and provision of arms to partners and allies. He always knew, he wrote, that his job would be morally complex. But he made himself a promise, he said, that he would only stay as long as he felt he could do more good than harm. And this month, he reached that point. Quote, I am leaving today because I believe that in our current course with regard to the continued, indeed expanded and expedited provision of lethal arms to Israel, I have reached the end of that bargain. Josh Paul joins me now. As Palestinian deaths from the Israeli bombardment of Gaza top 5,000 and just a few of the roughly 200 or so Israelis taken hostage by Hamas October 7th have been released. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, is among many who are demanding immediate Gaza ceasefire, and protests continue around the world. Josh Paul previously worked on security sector reform in both Iraq and the West Bank with additional roles in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, U.S. Army Staff, and as a congressional staffer. He grew up between London and New York and holds master's degrees from the universities of Georgetown and St. Andrews in Scotland. I'm very honored to have Josh Paul on the program. Thank you so much for joining me.
No, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this important issue.
Talk for just 1 minute about why you decided to go into the field that you did. When you talk about that more good than harm, what did you set out? What have you all these years set out to do?
So it has been a learning experience, I'll be very honest. I really entered the international security field in the wake of September 11th, as many Americans did, and particularly after the invasion of Iraq, where I was a young worker in D.C., looking for something different and a bit of excitement, and managed to get a job with the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, and did not go into that as the ideologue I think that I am now. But it was a deep learning experience through my time working with the Iraqi security forces and seeing and understanding what American foreign policy can look like on the ground, both the good and the very ugly. And ever since that experience, I have been very focused on integrating human rights into my work, both within and outside of the U.S. government.
What was it about this point? We're looking at the last 11 years of, if we're just going to talk about Israel-Palestine, 2009, 2014, 2,200 Palestinians dead in 3 weeks. Was it something qualitatively different about this moment, or just quantitatively, or what?
Both, actually. Quantitatively, yes. I think the outbreak of violence we are seeing in Gaza between Israel and Hamas is fundamentally different than that which we've seen. It is of a scale that we have not seen previously. And to be clear, that is down to Hamas in the first instance for its initial barbaric attack on Israeli civilians. But the scale of Israel's response as such as well has also been to date quantitatively different than we have seen. It is also qualitatively different. I have been involved in a large number of deeply challenging, morally complex policy-making decisions on arms transfers. The difference is that those have always had the chance to be debated, discussed, delayed, mitigated, and even when you knew that there wasn't necessarily an outcome that you supported, there was at least the confidence that you were handing over the case to Congress, because major arms sales require notification to Congress, where there could be further debate and discussion and efforts even to prevent such sales. In this instance, there is no such debate. There is simply an urgency to rush arms into a conflict where civilians are dying en masse. And that is what I don't understand. That is what I could not do anything to stop. And the lack of the lack of space in the administration and in Congress to have this discussion is why I thought that the only place to have it would be in the public eye.
Can you talk about what rules and guidelines and regulations currently govern U.S. arms sales to Israel and other countries like it?
Sure. So the fundamental laws are the Arms Export Control Act of 1976 and the Foreign Assistance Act of 1968. And those provide the fundamental basics on how and when arms should be transferred, including a legal caveat that arms may only be provided for certain purposes, such as defense and joint operations, and legitimate defense, and that they should only be used for the purpose for which they were provided. And as an aside, I think we can all agree that human rights violations and massive civilian casualties are not a reason for which U.S. arms are ever provided. On top of the law, every administration since the Reagan administration has issued a conventional arms transfer policy. This is the policy that shapes the thinking that is supposed to, and the analysis that is supposed to go into each of these decisions on a case-by-case basis about arms transfers as they move forward. The Biden administration's conventional arms transfer policy, to its credit, raised the bar to the highest level it has ever been for arms transfers with something called the more likely than not standard. It says that an arms transfer will not be authorized if it is more likely than not that the arms in question will be used to commit human rights violations of various types. And I think it is more than apparent that arms that we are providing to Israel, particularly precision-guided munitions for the conflict in Gaza, will be used. It is more likely than not, in fact, it is a near certainty, that they will be used for human rights violations and result in massive civilian casualties.
You told PBS recently that this wasn't the first time concerns, and even you have raised concerns about units within the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force.
Every other country, if there is grant U.S. military assistance going to a unit, that unit is vetted before it receives the assistance. In the case of Israel, we provide the assistance and then look out for reports of violations. And if there are reports of violations, those are brought up within a policy process within the State Department. There is consultation with Israel on its version of events. And then theoretically, a determination is made on whether a gross violation of human rights has occurred. Through this process, which is called the Israel Leahy vetting process, there has never been a determination that Israel has committed a gross violation of human rights. So I think that is obviously problematic when one looks at not necessarily even just Gaza, but the West Bank, where there are frequent reports of extrajudicial killings and of other abuses by Israeli security forces.
You mentioned a few of them in your letter. And in fact, in your letter, you make the fairly brave comparison between settler behavior and the Israeli juvenile detention system, unique in the world, and the actions of Hamas. Are you saying the settlers are terrorists?
I think certain settlers who attack civilians with the intent of causing, of using violence for political means. I mean, the use of violence for political purposes is the definition of terrorism.
There is widespread agreement that that violations have happened in the past before we even get to this conflict. And you made the point very clearly that the Biden administration specifically has established stronger guidelines on weapons transfers than the governments that preceded it. That being the case, how do you explain what's happening right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to there is, just an unwillingness to criticize Israel. It's a unique case, a special case. There are many reasons for that, some of them legitimate. But what it means at the end of the day is, I think, if you don't have a global standard, you don't have a standard.
Well, you also have Matt Miller, State Department spokesperson, saying we never violate any laws.
We comply with all applicable statutory requirements and regulatory requirements in our provision of military assistance to Israel, as we do to every other country in the world.
So I think Matt Miller might actually be technically correct in some ways. Many of these laws require the department to come to some sort of a determination before any sanctions or withholding of assistance occurs. If you never come to the determination, you've never broken the law. That said, I believe that the legal standards are rather lacking, and I believe that we should be holding ourselves to a stronger standard. Part of this also comes down to questions of interpretation of law.
You also said that it is in the hands of higher-ups.
The main policy decisions on Israel right now are being made from the top down, which again is atypical. For most arms sales, they sort of bubble their way up from the bottom. You get an application from a partner or from a U.S. company seeking a certain military capability, and that's a debate that, you know, gradually bubbles up to the decision makers. In this instance, the decision was made, and therefore there was no space for that bubbling, for that debate.
At the top is the president. Is he ultimately responsible?
Of course, these are his authorities.
Do we have a moment now with President Biden coming out right after you resigned, actually, urging Congress to approve, I think, more than $100 billion in aid for Israel, Ukraine, and I think Taiwan. Is there a moment now, especially to stop any of that, or is it going to go no matter what?
I think it's an important moment to talk about it because it highlights it, right? And the debate inevitably will go away in several months. This won't be something that is on the top of everyone's minds. And while it is, I think this is the opportunity to make an impression. Is it going to change anything in the short term? That I can't say. I think we have seen a slight shift over the last few days in the administration's approach. I think we've seen a change in tone, a greater focus on Palestinian civilian casualties and the harm that could be done. But in terms of the actions that underlie that, when we look at a supplemental request that has billions of dollars for arms and $100 million for humanitarian relief in Gaza, for example, I think I'm skeptical that the short term will make any difference, but I think the long term is much more promising.
You talked about the harm that could be done, and even as we speak, people are being killed. As we record this, Raji Sarani, the director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, spoke on Democracy Now! And basically said Palestinian civilians are in the eyes of the storm. They are the targets.
They destroyed Gaza. I mean, it's unbelievable. This army targeting only civilians and civilian targets, towers, houses, hospitals, churches, mosques, schools, shelter places, ambulances, nurses, doctors, journalists. This is the most ethical army. This is the most ethical army in the world. This is the mighty Israel. Its might and power targeting civilians. They are doing war crimes, crimes against humanity, persecution for 2.4 million people. for the last 18 days.
This is a moment of despair and fury. And I wonder, holding all of the civilian victims in our hearts at the same time, I certainly feel and weep for those whose families have been torn apart by the attacks of Hamas, whose relatives are held hostage still. But with all of that in your heart right now, how do you make sense of your effort and those of your colleagues to try to insert human rights kind of rules on war? Because it almost seems inevitable that in the name of right to defense, right to reprisal, governments do whatever the heck they like.
So, I mean, there are laws of war. They're not always necessarily enforceable. And of course, the U.S. has prevented the Palestinians from seeking restorative justice or justice of any kind through the International Criminal Court. So I think it's important to note that there are laws that apply, there are rules of conduct, and there are basic standards of human decency that apply. I think at the end of the day, as you said, what we're talking about here is not, does not boil down, should not boil down to Israel right or wrong. What we're ultimately talking about is the right of civilians, whether they be Palestinian or Israeli, to live in peace, to feel secure in their homes, secure from rocket attacks, and secure from F-16 drop precision-guided munitions. And I hope that this administration can take a look at our own historic policies, both in Israel and drawing from our experience in the region, not all of which is positive by any means, and push Israel and push all the parties towards a solution that is more just and that provides the peace that people who just want to live their everyday lives and raise their families deserve.
Like what? What would that solution look like? What would you propose right now if you still had your job inside the State Department?
So I think there are two streams there. One is with regards to the transfer of arms to Israel right now, which is, of course, what I was most directly involved in and what I retired over, or resigned over. And with regards to that, again, I would ask the Biden administration to follow its own laws, its own policies that it has set, and just to simply apply the same standard in the same space for debate to Israel as it has permitted or encouraged for conflicts and for partners elsewhere in the world. Beyond that, I think we need a radical re-envisioning of what the Middle East peace process looks like. I think it has broken down. I do not think, having served in Ramallah, that the two-state solution is viable. One need only look at the settlement, entrenched settlements and network of infrastructure supporting them, to understand that there is no way for a Palestinian state as conceived in Oslo to exist in that context. So is the answer to take apart, dismantle the settlements? I don't know how politically feasible that is in Israel, particularly if you look at the coalition that's in government now. And if that's not, then what is the answer and what are we pushing for? And what is the lesson of the last few decades? I think the policy approach from the US has been security for peace. That if Israel feels secure, it will feel comfortable making the concessions necessary to allow peace. But what we've seen instead is the more secure Israel feels, the more it has pushed the envelope, the more settlements have expanded, the more civil rights have been taken away from Palestinians in the West Bank, the more the siege of Gaza has continued. And so I think we need to step away from that way of thinking and ask if maybe instead of security for peace, there's some way of peace for security.
We need to stop the violence now. Vengeance is not a strategy. We need to negotiate and we need to get the captives out. That's what I'm saying. I call on everybody, on the Israeli government, on Hamas, and Canada, everybody to put pressure on both sides to negotiate and to get the captives out. My community is wiped out. It's incomprehensible. It's just, and it was very vicious, viciously done. But that's the point. That's the point. The only way to be safe is to have peace.
You see, some people anyway refer to as peace activists in Israel. I've actually heard quite a few of them who have referred to their lost relatives, people being held hostage, as peace activists against more suffering in their name inside Israel. Are there negotiating partners there for the kind of peace you're talking about?
I think there are negotiating partners on both sides. I think everyone, at the end of the day, even those who are, you know, on the extremes of both sides, ultimately everyone wants peace, right? I think that to get to negotiations requires trust and it requires leadership. And I think both are lacking right now on both sides, frankly.
What are the implications globally?
I think America faces a real challenge. There is a global competition for influence that is playing out from Latin America to the Middle East. I think the United States' edge in this competition, and certainly our most valuable tool, is our values. That is what sets us apart from authoritarian regimes around the world, including those who we are competing against. If we are seen to apply those values differently for different partners, if we are seen to be hypocritical, whether it is by standing against occupation in Ukraine but for it in Israel, or if we are seen to be pushing against civilian casualties and decrying the harm that is caused by them in some contexts, but turning a blind eye or even facilitating them in another, I think that does irreparable harm to the broader U.S. interest, which I actually believe is the global interest, that the values that we espouse and I hope believe in are the ones that ultimately shape the future of the world.
You also at the beginning said that your views have evolved since your time in Iraq and your time living in Ramallah. Can you just talk about how?
When you are living amongst a community, which was certainly more the case in Ramallah than in Iraq, you hear different perspectives, you are exposed to different cultures, and you live the life. And I think, you know, particularly in the West Bank, when you see the life the Palestinians have, the humiliation, the constant humiliation at checkpoints, the constant, incursions by Israeli military forces, you come to understand different perspectives, and that's just a function of living overseas. I think as well, having worked for the U.S. government, the United States has an immense amount of power around the world and an immense amount of influence and presence, and that comes with an immense amount of responsibility, and you feel that. You are challenged working for the U.S. government, I think with questions and problems that you would not be working for many other governments. Not because we are better or worse, but because we are more involved in so many of these complex questions.
So what can be done? I'm sure there are people in our audience who, whatever, wherever they stand on culpability for this particular round of violence, want to see an end to it and want to see peace. What can they do right now to perhaps to support civil service like the ones you're hearing from who are saying, we're still deciding to be inside trying to do good? Are there things civil society outside can do to support people like that?
Yeah, there are three things I will point to. The first is a bit of a cliche, but it really does matter. Contact your member of Congress, contact your senator. I've worked in a congressional office, and I know how we used to sit down with the member of Congress on a weekly basis, review the call logs and go through them and say, okay, we've had 5 calls on this side, we've had 7 calls on that side. And that really does inform how members of Congress think about their votes. So that really is an important thing to do. The second thing is, I would say, reach out to your local media. There are reporters for what's left anyway of local media who cover local communities and how they are reacting to world events. Make sure they're getting your side of the story. And the third thing, of course, is organize. And there are some good organizations already out there. So for example, there's the Alliance for Peacebuilding, is one organization which does a lot of good work bringing communities together around both local conflict resolution and global conflict issues. So I think those are the three things I would recommend.
Do you have a message for people still working in the administration and in the jobs, the desks that were next to yours before you left?
Sure. I think everyone does what they can based on the circumstances they live in. I would say to them that you have a unique opportunity to do good. And as I discovered, it's possible to do more good in one day within certainly the State Department and around the U.S. government than many people can hope to achieve in a lifetime. Use that opportunity. I think you're in a place of immense responsibility. and the opportunity to speak up. You don't have to win every fight. You don't have to fight every fight. But you are in a place where you can really make a difference, and I hope you do.
This wasn't just any other fight.
Not me.
Thank you very much, Josh Paul. I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a truism to say that what we measure, we tend to treasure, and we sure can measure U.S. military spending year after year. In 2023, that number stood at almost $800 billion. And researchers at Brown University calculate we've spent some $8 trillion on war since 9/11 alone. Has all of that spending made the world a safer, more peaceful place? Or has it simply ratcheted up a global war economy? Unfortunately, as the people of Israel discovered after the horrific terror attacks by Hamas on October 7th, force alone cannot be relied upon to keep a people safe against an enemy with a grievance that has boiled over into war. So how about it? How about we invest as much in war prevention and in conflict resolution as we invest in our war economy? It is at least worth a try. How about departments of peace at every level, national, local, regional? Could we embed our local economies as effectively in making peace and resolving conflict as we have embroiled them in making tools for war? I believe we can. And Josh Paul, in our extended conversation, says that the lesson from the Northern Irish peace process is that focus is required. You can find my full unedited conversation with Josh Paul through a subscription to our podcast. In the meantime, stay kind, stay curious, and thanks for joining me. For the Laura Flanders Show, I'm Laura. Till the next time. For more on this episode and other forward-thinking content, subscribe to our free newsletter for updates, my commentaries, and our full uncut conversations. We also have a podcast. It's all at lauraflanders.org.
Welcome back, and that was an interview with Josh Paul, who resigned 2 weeks ago from the U.S. State Department, working in the area of arms procurement, to the announcement by the Biden administration that it would step up significantly the supply of arms to the State of Israel in its siege against the people of Gaza. Also, another interview with the Hamas resistance movement, a spokesperson for Hamas, Osama Hamdan, Hamas being labeled as a terrorist organization by the United States, by Britain and other countries in Western Europe, but not all countries in Europe, is very rarely heard from. Many attributes, negative attributes, are designated to Hamas. We'll listen to an interview with Osama Hamdan of the Hamas resistance movement, where he discusses the objectives and strategic outlook of the resistance movement. Let's listen in.
As Israel continues what's being described by human rights organizations as an attempted genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Gaza, the war of narratives continues. Israel and its allies in Washington, London, Paris, and practically every other European capital insist that Tel Aviv is defending itself against Hamas, which they consider to be a terrorist organization that has committed atrocities. The thousands that have been killed in Gaza are at worst unfortunate collateral for a necessary war that Israel must win, or at best made-up numbers. That's essentially what many Israeli and Western officials have been saying. Hamas has been accused of decapitating babies, launching rockets from hospitals, using civilians as human shields, and fabricating the numbers of those killed. Let's take a sidebar and talk to Osama Hamdan, a spokesperson of Hamas and a senior member of the group. Mr. Osama Hamdan, thank you very much for joining us on Sidebar. I want to start by asking a question that many people have been asking. Why did Hamas undertake the operations and conduct the attack on October 7th this year?
Well, it's clear that Hamas announced that from the first day. According to the policies of this government led by Netanyahu, he was planning and he was acting to make an end for the Palestinian cause, attacking Al-Aqsa Mosque, trying to divide the mosque between the Muslims and the Jewish people, trying to Judaize the holy city of Al-Quds, and building new settlements in West Bank. I have to remind everyone that in a few months, this government issued 150 orders to build new settlements or to build more apartments in available settlements. And they are putting us on the seas. They are undermining the chances for building a Palestinian state. And they are trying to avoid all the needs of the Palestinians, killing more Palestinians every day. So there must be a reaction, and that was the reaction from the resistance, because we have warned everyone the policies of the Israeli government is creating instability. It will lead for more complications. In fact, the Israelis were not listening to anyone. I believe the military operation was to clarify that the Palestinians are still standing for their rights. They are still willing to have their independent sovereign state with Al-Quds, Jerusalem as a capital. And also they will defend their rights even if there was no support for them.
Does the policies of building illegal settlements or trying to take over Al-Aqsa Mosque, does this justify killing innocent women and children and civilians in kibbutzes and, as reported and claimed by the Israelis, decapitating babies?
Well, everyone knows that was not the real story. And unfortunately, the international media are still asking the same question after 20 days of killing the Palestinians in Gaza. And after 75 years of the occupation, killing the Palestinians every day. Israel started by killing the Palestinians, and they are continuing that. The massacre of Deir Yassin in 1948, the massacres of Al-Tantura, Kfar Qasim, the massacre of Sabra and Shatila, 3,000 Palestinians, women, children, and old men were killed in 2 days. And we are talking now about the massacre in Gaza. So they have the history of killing the Palestinians all the time, and now someone is shouting they are killing the women and the children. They are doing this and that. Why the fact is not like this? Everyone knows that they are lying, and they know that they are lying. I have to tell you to what Yair Lapid have said a few days ago. He said for the international media, if the international media was objective, it will serve Hamas. If the international media reports both sides, it will serve Hamas. If you, as international media, created symmetry on both sides, it will serve Hamas. Why he is saying this? Because he knows that his story is lies, and this story cannot stand from the real facts on the ground, which is the occupation. The problem is the occupation. No one has to start asking about any consequences. You have to start from scratch point. Why all this is happening? Because of the occupation. So the solution, you don't have to ask the victim why you have reacted. You have to ask the occupier why you are occupying the Palestinian lands, why you are killing the Palestinians, and you have to make an end for this occupation.
Mr. Hamdan, I've spoken to several Israeli officials, amongst them the architect of the Oslo Accords, who said that Mr. Yossi Beilin, who said that the problem isn't the occupation. The problem is that Hamas took over Gaza, and that Hamas doesn't know, as he's put it, doesn't know how to behave. And that if Hamas behaved the way in which that the Israelis expect them to behave, then all of the killings that are taking place in Gaza wouldn't happen. Why don't you behave the way the Israelis want you to behave?
Okay, well, this is the mentality of the occupation. You have to behave as the occupation likes you to behave. You have to be a slave. You have to be obeying the orders of the Israeli occupation. And if you did that, you will be a good guy. that returns us to the old sayings of the Israelis.
But it would save the lives of all the thousands of Palestinians being killed, no?
Well, it will not save them. The Hamas is not ruling West Bank. Who is killing the Palestinians there? In the last year, 500 Palestinians were killed by the Israelis. And this year, from day number one, from the 7th of October, 110 Palestinians were killed by the Israelis. And before that, 300 Palestinians were killed from the 1st of January this year. So we are talking about 400 Palestinians were killed by the Israelis in West Bank, where Hamas is not there, where Hamas is not ruling, where there is a coordination on the security level between the Palestinian authority there, where Abu Mazen is saying daily that he is against the resistance and he's against saying anything which may harm the Israelis. And they are killing the Palestinians, building more settlements, taking over the Palestinian land. This is the mentality of the occupation. You have to obey the occupation. You have to accept the fact of the occupation. He is saying the same words of Smotrich, which he has said a few weeks ago, when he had said the Palestinians have three options, either to accept the occupation as a reality, or they have to leave to another place, or we will kill them. So they are both. The one who created Oslo agreements and the one who was undermining Oslo agreements. It's the mentality of the occupation. He defends himself by saying he is a good side of the story while he is killing the Palestinian. If you are a good side, you have to withdraw from the occupied Palestinian land.
I want to ask you about the issue of captives or hostages or prisoners, whatever people want to describe them as. We've seen Hamas release four so far. The last two were elderly women, a grandmother. Why did Hamas kidnap, how can you justify Hamas kidnapping a grandmother, an elderly woman, as we saw?
Well, I think we have answered that several times, and there was a clear answer from Abu Ubaidah, the spokesman of Al-Qassam troops. He said clearly that we have taken war prisoners from the Israeli soldiers and officers in the army and in the Shabak. This is the fact. And the huge fall of the Israeli army encouraged everyone to come inside. Those people of Gaza who was under the siege for 17 years, who was being killed, bombed all those years by the Israelis in 2008, 2009, 2012, 2014, and 2021, they acted against those settlers who took over their homelands, who took over their original land, and they bring those people. And we called them from day number one, they are not hostages, they are not war prisoners, they are captives, and we will release them as soon as the situation has changed.
So you're saying now, if you don't mind me asking, you are saying now, you're claiming now that Hamas fighters did not take any non-combatants. The only people that the Hamas fighters took were soldiers or members of the security services?
We don't need to take more than this, because the huge fall down of the Israeli army gave you a good chance to have more prisoners. In fact, Mohammed Daif, the leader of Al-Qassam troops, in his message for the fighters before starting the operation, he said, you don't have to attack old men, women, children, don't kill, don't harm. Even the soldiers who are wounded, you don't have to kill them. This is our values and this is our morals. And whatever the Israelis are trying to say, they are lying. I believe they are lying. The whole idea of the Israelis is you have to lie and to lie and to lie, and then everyone will believe you. And they have a huge support from some countries who supported them, like United States and allies, and supported them by the media to keep saying the same story without any changes, even with the real stories. You have to realize, I think you realize, what one of those two Israeli women have said. She said, they treated us in a good way. They behaved in a good way towards us. And all the Israelis, officials and in the media, they have said it was a great problem, a great disaster, the speech of this woman, because it undermines the story of Israel.
I want to ask you actually about the testimony of that elderly Israeli woman who did come out, and she did say that she was treated well and she ate from the same food as the fighters, who even cleaned the toilets for her and so forth. Yes, that undermines the narrative of the Israelis, but Hamas releasing those prisoners or those hostages or captives, doesn't it undermine Hamas in front of its own supporters when you have Palestinians who are in Israeli jails, amongst them one who was killed by torture in the West Bank just a couple of days ago? How do you justify to your supporters releasing the captives you have whilst Palestinian captives remain in Israeli jails? They don't have the right to have their families visiting them or to see lawyers. Their food is being cut off. And like I say, there's been reports of them essentially being tortured to death.
Well, this is the difference between the supporters of Hamas and the Israelis. The Israelis are seeking to kill more Palestinians. They are seeking to see more blood of the Palestinians. They are seeking to kill more children and women of the Palestinians because they are occupiers. All what they want is to get rid of the Palestinian people and nation. On our side, Hamas supporters, they are seeking to have their liberation. They wanted their country to be liberated. They wanted to be their sons, husbands in the jails to be liberated. They understand that you can't have a prisoner's exchange unless you have soldiers as war prisoners. And everyone knows that we have them, so it's okay, and we are doing the right thing when we are releasing those people, old women, or some others, because it's our values, it's our ethics. So our supporters have said nothing wrong about that. In fact, they believe that the leadership of Hamas was acting in the right way when those people were released.
I spoke to Danny Ayalon, the former assistant foreign minister, former Israeli assistant foreign minister, and when I asked him about the number of Palestinians killed in Gaza, of which there are, according to health officials in Gaza, more than 2,000 children who have been killed in the Gaza Strip since Israel began its war on the besieged enclave, he claimed that those numbers were inaccurate. He said that Gaza is controlled by Hamas, and Hamas is lying about those numbers, and that those numbers aren't true. Why are you making up numbers?
Well, this is the difference between Hamas and Israel also. They are lying, and they are preventing anyone to see the facts. Well, they are closing the hospital. They don't allow anyone to go in.
Are you willing to allow for the international community or for journalists or for the Red Cross to come and check these numbers in Gaza?
Exactly. While all the journalists are in front of all the hospitals and they can see film, picture, everything. They know the facts. They saw the bodies. They saw the pieces of the bodies. They saw the beheaded children and women by Israeli bombs. They saw the melted bodies by the Israeli bombs provided by the United States. All that was seen, filmed by the media. While you can't go to any hospital in Israel. In fact, you can't film any place in Israel which was attacked. This is what they are doing, and they claim that we are doing the same. Okay, Gaza is open. Any international media is there, can see what is happening. Those numbers are facts and being seen by all the media. A few hours before talking to you, one of your colleagues in Al Jazeera, He faced the fact that all his family was bombed, his wife, his son, his daughter, and one of his grandsons were killed. The media, all the media have seen that. So those are not numbers. Those are people, humans. They have names. They have relatives. They have mothers, fathers, brothers, and sisters. And everyone knows them by the names. If you want, you can have a list of those names.
I want
while
to ask
Israel,
you, Mr. Hamdan,
you have nothing.
Are you willing, can you tell me categorically now, are you willing to allow for an organization such as the International Red Cross or the United Nations or even the European Union or even the United States to come into Israel, to come into Gaza and to see how many people have been killed, to see the hospitals and to check whether or not Hamas is or Hamas fighters are hiding in those hospitals?
Well, I have to tell you, the Red Cross is available. The United Nations is there. The UNRWA is there. And the media, foreign media is there. So they are all there. And they have all the access to see everything. And everyone knows that there was and there is no militants in the hospital. We don't need to be in the hospitals. Those hospitals are not a place to hide the militants. The militants are on the borders. 2 days ago, an Israeli tank tried to invade the lands of Gaza. 3 meters after they have approached Gaza, our fighters acted against that, destroying this tank. If they were hiding in the hospital, they will not be able to do this. Anyone is welcome, except the United States, because they are part of the war against our people. They are spying. They have declared yesterday that they are participating in the fight by Delta Force. We don't have, till now, any information about that, but they have declared that by themselves. So they are part of the fight against our nation. They don't have the right to check in what is happening because they are spying on our people. Any other countries, any other organizations, they have a full right to come. We are welcoming them and we welcome them to come and to see the facts and to see the real massacre and to know that Netanyahu is the new Hitler in this world. He is the Hitler of this century.
One of the oldest churches in the world was bombed by the Israelis. Why do you believe, or why is it that there hasn't been an outcry from Christian nations over this attack on the church?
Well, you have to ask them. You have to ask Mr. Macron, who is talking against the Palestinians, who is supporting the Israelis. Ask him if he dares to ask about the church, because it's a hypocrisy. This world, the United States and Europe, most of Europe, they are acting in a hypocritic way. They just saw the victim and they defend Israel. They are not talking about the church. It's not the first time where there is an attack against the church. They don't talk about churches, mosques, which was attacked. I believe you have to ask them this question and they can't have any answer except one answer, because it's Israel.
I want to finish off with two questions. The first question, Mr. Hamdan, is the attack on October 7th, just to go back to it to set up my final question here. Did Hamas expect it to be as big as it was, basically? Did you expect to reach that deep into across the border? Did you expect to take as many prisoners of war as you mentioned? Was it expected to be that scale, or was Hamas planning for something smaller?
Well, as was declared from Al-Qassam troops, the plan was to attack all the military surrounding Gaza, which is known as Gaza Brigades. In fact, the expectations was not like this. At least the timing was around 24 hours to take over all those places. It happened in 4 hours. And it shows how Israel army is not as it was described. And this is why the Americans are furious. This is why Israel is bombing the children and women. Because you show the entire world that this occupation is not as strong as they described. This occupation, which the United States trying to normalize the relation between this occupation and the Arab world, based on they have a good and well-organized and strong army, they have good and strong security, they have technology, they have good economics, all that fall down in the 7th of October. So this is the fact. We expected to act in a good way, but we did not expect them in this bad situation.
Finally, I want to ask you about the way forward. This war has gone on now for almost 3 weeks. The death and destruction is unquestionable. The scenes are harrowing, really. How does this end? What is Hamas's end game with regards to this?
Well, destruction shows the real face of Israel. It shows that there is no chances to believe that Israel is seeking peace. shows that the idea of peace cannot be implemented with Israel. It shows that anyone is talking about peace is not doing anything, because if you want to see peace in the region, you have to prevent Israel from killing the Palestinians. You have to make an end for the occupation. What I believe, it may take a few days, maybe weeks, to make an end for this attack against Gaza. But at the end of the issue, the big question will remain. What about the occupation? What about the presence of the occupation? If anyone believes that the Palestinians will surrender, will stop resisting the occupation, he doesn't think well. I have to remind everyone that those people who are fighting in Gaza, West Bank, everywhere against Israel, they were, most of them, most of the fighters, they were born after Oslo agreements. If there was real peace, they were supposed to act in a different way. If the occupation continued, those children who are seeing now their fathers, mothers, brothers, friends are being killed, bombed by the Israelis, they have only one option. They will continue the resistance until they will get rid from the occupation. So this is the point. You have to make an end for the occupation.
Mr. Osama Hamdan, thank you very much for your time and for joining us here on Sidebar.
Thank you.
That was an interview of Hamas Resistance Movement spokesman Osama Hamdan. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, October 29th, 2023. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll take a break. We'll be back with our concluding segment for the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for today.
I and I don't make up, I and I mind to go through the same thing like I and I forbearance not true.
No people die. Cry, Lord Africa, cry, blood. Cry, blood Africa, cry, blood. Cry, cry, blow.
Cry, Africa. Say that they will fly my sister. They were so presumptuous. Who dare them to say that? Cry. Africa, cry, blow. Cry, Africa, cry, blow. Cry, and high, and high, and high. Come this day to fetch such foundation, up and foundation in. If anyone should trouble, cry, cry Africa, cry. It's about time
Baba. No trouble, Africa. Cry. Free up, Africa. Cry.
Of Burning Spear with the track entitled Cry Africa Blood. And our final segment that deals with the impact of the siege of Gaza on children. Let's listen to this report.
More than a million children in Gaza face daily attack from Israeli bombs and missiles. More than 3,000 youngsters have been killed in 3 weeks in a campaign backed by the US and the West. What's the impact of Israel's war on Palestinian children? This is Inside Story. Hello there, I'm James Bayes. More than half of Gaza's 2.3 million people are children living in fear of Israeli bombardment. Youngsters also make up more than 40% of more than 7,000 Palestinians killed so far by Israeli strikes. In most places, the noise of aircraft overhead would have children scurrying with excitement to scan the skies. In Gaza, they're the sound of death in a place where childhood is already scarred by siege and war. For those who survive Israel's attacks, the long-term impact of such trauma is almost unimaginable. We'll be discussing all this with our panel of guests in a few moments. But first, this report from Victoria Gatenby.
Awad Abu Shimala carries the body of his nephew Elias through the streets of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. The health ministry says more than 3,000 Palestinian children like Elias have been killed in Israeli airstrikes since October the 7th.
This is one of my nephews. My brother's wife and children were all killed. Elias was injured 2 weeks ago, and because all the border crossings are closed, we couldn't move him for medical reasons, and he died. There is no medicine for efficient treatment. The doctors did their best.
Children make up nearly half of Gaza's population of 2.3 million. The UN estimates that 400 children are being killed or injured in Israeli attacks every single day.
The Israeli army is recording victories over children, knowing full well that it will not achieve its real goals. God is our only solace.
Humanitarian agencies had documented trauma in Palestinian children here long before this war began. The Israeli occupation and blockade, previous conflicts, and the COVID-19 pandemic are just some of the challenges they've endured in their short lives. Now they face a battle for survival in a place where the UN says civil order has collapsed.
Gaza is on the brink of a massive health hazard as the risk of diseases are looming. Gaza is being strangled. The people of Gaza feel shunned, alienated, and abandoned.
Gaza's 1 million children are being killed or injured, forcibly displaced and collectively punished. Innocent victims in an increasingly brutal war. Victoria Gatenby for Inside Story.
Let's bring in our guests to discuss all this. In Amman, it's Tanya Haj Hassan, a pediatric intensive care doctor who's worked in Gaza. She co-founded Gaza Medic Voices, a social media account that shares first-hand testimonies from healthcare workers in the Strip. In occupied East Jerusalem, we have Jason Lee, the country director of Save the Children in the Occupied Palestinian Territories. And in London, Yara Eid, a war journalist who spent her childhood in Gaza. Thank you all for spending your time with us. If I can start with you, Jason, just to get some context here about the population of Gaza, 2.3 million people, but about half are children, is that right?
Absolutely. You have the majority of people, the civilians living in Gaza now, being a child. Now, 1.4 million people have fled their homes. And half of them are children, and they're sheltering wherever they can. There is no place in Gaza that is safe right now. The bombardments, the airstrikes have continued in the north and the south, where the situation where the civilian death toll has hit more than 7,000 civilians, almost 3,000 of those being children. We are now having a situation where one child is killed every 13 minutes. That's one child every 13 minutes. The vast numbers of civilians that have been injured, more than 18,500, again, one out of every three of those being a child. Every conflict disproportionately affects children, and we're seeing yet again in this conflict, children are paying the heaviest price with their lives, with being injured, and not to mention the scars that they will carry with them for the remainder of their lives.
Dr. Tanya, you've worked in Gaza. So we're talking about a million children who are in Gaza under this relentless Israeli bombardment. And 3 weeks in, we have 3,000 children killed. That means Israel in 3 weeks has killed about 1,000 children a week. This is the fifth Gaza war. We saw horrors from those previous wars. Did you think it could ever get to this?
I mean, I don't think anybody's mind should go there. It's really horrific. You know, a few days ago, UNICEF released a report. This was 700 children ago. Since then, we've had 700 further children die. They said, and I quote, "The situation in the Gaza Strip is a growing stain on our collective conscience. The rate of death and injuries of children is simply staggering." And I think that's the way most people who listen to the news in that region would react. It's staggering, and it is a stain on our collective conscience. And you know, these aren't just numbers. You know, these are children with families, parents who love them, siblings, identities, hopes, dreams, subjectivity, and inner world. And there's a risk of reducing them to numbers because we get habituated to hearing these numbers. But you know, just like Israeli children have biographies, families, identities, hopes, and those have been shared with us, these over 3,000 children. And I just want to clarify, that number is the children that we're able to count in those statistics. There are over 900 children in the Gaza Strip that are missing right now, or missing from that figure right now, because they have not, their bodies have not been able to be retrieved from under the rubble. So we're talking about over 4,000 children likely at this point. And I completely agree with UNICEF. This is a growing stain on our collective conscience.
Yara, these clearly aren't numbers for you. You grew up in the Gaza Strip. These are friends and family members.
I've already lost 41 members of my family and two of my colleagues.
First, can I please express my condolences? This is awful.
And from the 41 members of my family, you know, 17 of them are children. And those children were really loved, you know, they were the light in our family. I used to babysit most of them. Whenever I went back home, I would be the babysitter, you know. I had so many memories with them. Every single one of them had dreams. Every single one of them had a special character. And they all were very cheerful despite everything they've been living through, you know. Children are the reason why I wanted to become a journalist in the first place. place, because, you know, usually their voices are those that are not heard and they're unable to articulate what they're living through. And as a kid myself, when I was a kid, I felt that, you know, I felt like the whole world doesn't care about me as a Palestinian kid. And I genuinely think that, you know, Israel stole my childhood. Israel stole all of my memories from being a kid. You know, Israel stained my childhood. I was 14 years old when I saw people getting cut into pieces in front of my eyes. I was only 8 years old when I first experienced terror and you know, attacks on my school. I remember, I will never forget, I was doing my Arabic exam, Arabic final exam. I was in grade 3. And next to our school, there was a very severe bomb. And I remember my teachers just, you know, panicking and seeing all of the children crying. And this was the first aggression in Gaza. And right now we're in 2023 and we're seeing, you know, this is the sixth aggression since 2008. And Palestinians in Gaza, you know, the kids, if we're only gonna, you know, look at the kids, every single one of them, more than 90% of Palestinian children are, you know, suffering from PTSD, me included, and my brother as well, and most of my relatives for that matter, most of the kids in my family and our friends, you know. What we've been living through in Gaza, it did not just start on the 7th of October. This has been my whole life, you know. I grew up with the sound of bombs more than the sound of birds. I grew up, you know, being scared of the sound of airplanes. Till now, I'm in London and there's airplanes a lot in London, and I'm still, you know, suffering from severe PTSD that even when the fire alarm goes off, any loud noise still triggers me. I've been trying to get treatment for my PTSD for the last 7 years, and I'm not even close to being, you know, treated from what I've seen and the horrific, you know, atrocities that were committed against me and my people. And every single war, I almost got killed. You know, I just feel very lucky that I'm still alive. But every single Palestinian child in Gaza never felt that they can be, you know, alive for the next moment or not.
Jason, we've mentioned lots of figures at the start of this program, and we know it's over 3,000 children killed. The figure may be much higher. It's worth bringing up the fact that there have been challenges to those figures. President Biden saying, "I have no notion that the Palestinians are telling the truth about how many people are killed." He went on, "I'm sure innocents have been killed. It's the price of waging a war." Can I ask you to weigh in on the figures? Because after he said that, the Ministry of Health produced this, which is a list of all those that died, a very detailed list with all of the names of those that have been killed and all of their details. From your perspective, from your organization Save the Children, what do you make of these official statistics that come from the Ministry of Public Health? Do you think they are accurate? Let's just be clear on that.
Yeah. So de facto authorities have been running the health system in Gaza for the last 16 years. And when you look through the previous escalations, which unfortunately there have been many, the figures that have been released by the Ministry of Public Health in, again, de facto authorities in Gaza, ministry officials, when you compare those to the official UN figures that are released, they're pretty much identical. There are slight variations, but again, these are very small in number, but they're pretty much accurate. So when we look through, again, historical evidence on what has the ministry been producing in previous escalations with what the UN numbers are, There is no discrepancy between them. So the figures that, again, are being used are the ones that until now have not shown to be discredited in any way, shape or form, and unfortunately, the previous countless escalations that have taken place in Gaza.
Yara, one of the most disturbing things I've heard in recent days, and there is so much disturbing information that we're all consuming, is the fact that families now are splitting their children up and putting them in different places so a whole family doesn't get wiped out. And also that parents are writing children's names on their arms so if they are killed, they can identify them, and others are putting identity bracelets on their children. This is shocking.
You know, this is not the first time that this is happening. Unfortunately, it is the most brutal, most barbaric attack on Gaza you know, ever. But and you know, children are literally more than 70% of all the people who have been killed and casualties are children and women. So what's happening is a clear, you know, violation of international law. But this has been my life. You know, I remember in 2014, my mother is a UN staff member, an UNRWA staff member, and she had to be working to help the refugees who are, you know, being displaced and seeking shelter in UNRWA schools that are supposed to be safe. But as we know, Israel keeps bombing those UNRWA schools, and nowhere in Gaza is actually safe. But even then, my mom took my brother with her in 2014, and I had to stay with my father. Even though I was, as a 14-year-old, I was crying. I was like, no, mama, like, you can't. Like, I need to come with you. We have to be together as a family. And she said, Yara, if me and Firas, my brother, get killed, you know, you and your dad have to be alive. You know, we have to split you. And this is just my story, my family. Complete families are doing the same thing, you know, splitting their families in half. And sometimes even if they split the families in half, the whole family is being wiped from the civil registry. You know, so many families have been completely obliterated. Only from my family, 41 members. And you can imagine, you know, my family is a big family, but you can imagine all of the other families that are smaller. You know, this writing, children, you know, when I think about it, and when I think back to my childhood and I relive the trauma that I was living, I honestly cannot even put it into words what I felt as a child. You know, I didn't even understand what death meant. I didn't understand the destruction. I didn't understand. My parents, you know, tried to make me understand what's happening. But, you know, it only was when I was 14 that I realized what losses meant. And when I was really, you know, caught in a massacre and I survived by a miracle, that's when I realized what it means to be between a life and death situation, you know. And so many of these children are having to, you know, age, like, you know, they're not children anymore. They're having, you know, one of my my cousin's children, she's the only survivor from her whole family. Her three sisters, both grandparents, both parents were killed. Hala is only 8 years old. She's going to grow up without any member of her family, you know. Her uncles were killed, her aunts were killed, and till now, I am unable to talk to her. I don't know what to tell her. I don't know how she's feeling. I can never even imagine what she has to go through. You know, her sisters, her whole memories. She's only 8, and she has to live for the rest of her life without her parents and her sisters. You know, and those pictures are not only heartbreaking, but they're, as the doctor said, you know, it is a stain on our consciousness, and it is a stain on humanity for letting this continue for more than, like, you know, 20 days. It's not like, you know, one massacre that has been committed in one day and we could have stopped it. No, Israel continues to massacre children. The figures are continuing to increase. We're seeing horrific, horrific accounts from journalists on the ground that are risking their own lives to produce these pictures, these graphic pictures of children, you know, videos that not only break hearts, like, I am literally unable to sleep since aggression started. I barely sleep 3 hours a day because of those pictures that haunt me. And the world is just watching, you know. Biden is there giving the green light to Israel to continue what they're doing, massacring children, you know. And I'm shocked, you know. I never thought, I genuinely thought, you know, our world can't be this horrible, but every single Palestinian right now feels like this is not our world, you know. I don't know.
Well, let me bring in Tanya on this, because we've talked about the bombardment, but of course the other factor here is the aid not getting in, very limited aid, and the specific that they're not allowing in, the Israelis, is fuel. From your perspective as a doctor, how important is fuel for those hospitals, for keeping the hospitals running, for running things like ventilators and incubators for newborn babies?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I just want to address a couple of things that were shared in the last few minutes by my co-speakers today. You know, just in reference to what Yara was saying earlier, and to put things in context for our viewers, a child of age 11 today would have lived through 4 major bombardments up until this point. And then in reference to something else that we were just discussing, you know, there's this deep sense of being alone by Gazans and Palestinians in general that I've spoken to, so colleagues that I have in the field in Gaza who have sent messages saying, you know, we feel like 2 days ago one of my colleagues sent us a message to say, we feel like the whole world has come together to eliminate us and nobody's listening to us and the world is deaf to our suffering. And I think, you know, first of all, I think that should be very alarming to the people listening to this program today. But I also think it's reflective of a particular type of psychological trauma, of feeling completely isolated and feeling like the world is voluntarily silent to your pain and suffering. One of my colleagues today said in Gaza said, the whole world is watching us getting massacred on TV and just silently watching. And so just in reference to the number question that you provided to Jason from Save the Children, you know, I think kind of discrediting the deaths is part of that dehumanization. So I just wanted to make that point, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, and Tanya, on the specifics of not allowing fuel in as a doctor, how is that going to impact the medical situation on the ground?
So just for context, fuel operates everything from the ambulances that go to collect people from under the rubble, to go pick up pregnant women who are delivering or others who are having heart attacks. You know, we rely on our paramedic services in normal times. You can imagine in times of crisis like this how important having fuel for that is. Fuel is needed to bring the aid, the very little aid that is coming in to the locations it's needed to be delivered to. And then on a hospital level, fuel operates just about, or electricity actually, more accurately, operates just about everything in my subspecialty, which is critical care medicine, from ventilators to monitors to infusion pumps. And without those things, you cannot run an intensive care unit. And without those things, patients who are without electricity, and I want to make the distinction between fuel and electricity, because the electricity supply has been cut off of Gaza Strip, and fuel is really what's needed to operate the generators, which in pre-October 7th times are the backup system for the hospital's electricity. So it would be needed to operate ventilators. If a patient is dependent on a ventilator, which many patients in intensive care are, and you cannot operate the ventilator or suddenly you run out of fuel, those patients will die. It is a death sentence. They are unable to breathe, they suffocate, they die. The same is true for patients who are dependent on dialysis. There's over 1,000 patients who are dependent on dialysis. And if we cannot operate the dialysis machines, those patients unfortunately will die. The same is true for neonatal units where newborn babies are taken care of. And newborn babies are often in incubators, they're often on breathing machines. All of these things require electricity. And the second the generators can no longer provide that electricity because the fuel has run out, those newborn premature babies will die. And we know there are more than 130 of them. And so it's essentially a lack of fuel is an ultimate death sentence on multiple levels. And I've sort of talked about the hospital intensive care level of things, but there's also, you know, bakeries have closed down because they don't have fuel to operate the bakeries, and bakeries are needed to provide fuel. Water desalination plants cannot function because, again, they need electricity to desalinate the water. So even Gaza's internal abilities to provide drinking water are stifled.
Let me bring in Jason now on this, because the other additional factor to all of this is that there are people on the move everywhere in Gaza, in part because Israel is threatening them, telling them they have to move, but also they're trying to find somewhere safe, and clearly there is no safe place in Gaza. I looked at some of the UN statistics. They said about 1 million people displaced, include 4,750 pregnant women, 390 postnatal cases requiring medical attention, and the UN saying they're increasingly identifying acute respiratory and diarrhea among children under 5. Tell us about not those in hospital, but those that aren't under medical care and the ordeal they're facing, Jason.
Absolutely. We estimate there's about 1.4 million people
that have fled their homes. Now, they're sheltering wherever they can, in schools, UN facilities, public buildings, hospitals. The infrastructure that people are moving to in the south, and those even that remain in the north, cannot cope with the numbers of people. There are 650,000, that's a huge amount of people, trying to shelter in 150 shelters in the south that was not built for that capacity. Many of the shelters are hosting up to four times as many people as they were built for. That means there's no food, inadequate supplies of food, inadequate supplies of water, and bathroom facilities. In one center, there is 16 bathrooms for about 25,000 people. And there's no water, so you can't flush. There's no water to maintain hygiene practices. There's no water to drink. Again, I want to reiterate, fuel is critical to ensure that the desalination plants work, that the pumps are working to actually bring up the groundwater. Civilians and children are now resorting to drinking brackish water or saline water because there's not enough fresh water for them to drink. Now, even the journey to the south, I mean, many people are still remaining in the north because it has not been safe for them to move. Despite the evacuation orders to move to the south, the journey to the south was perilous. My own teams and their families had to flee from their homes in the north to take shelter in the south.
Okay, Tanya, we had a warning in recent hours from the head of UNRWA, that's the UN agency that deals with Palestinians, the Commissioner General, Philippe Lazzarini, and he's now saying things could get even worse. He says there is a risk of serious disease and starvation.
That is certainly true. I think you have thousands of people sheltering, as Jason was saying, in environments that are meant for a very small fraction of that number sharing the same lavatories and drinking unhygienic water. We already know that there's been a spike in diarrheal disease illness amongst children in the Gaza Strip. We don't have reports of cholera yet, but an outbreak of cholera in these sort of dense settings would be catastrophic. And unfortunately, in these circumstances, is not uncommon at all. I think we know there's been an uptick in chickenpox and other contagious diseases as a consequence of people living in very close proximity, sheltering all together in these types of settings.
We're coming near the end of the program, and I'd like to give the last word to Yara. Yara, given what we're hearing, this desperate stories about the plight of people in Gaza, and particularly children in Gaza, if you were able to speak to President Biden right now on behalf of the children in Gaza, what would you tell the President of the United States right now?
Well, I'll certainly start by saying that I'm shocked by your actions, you know, that you have blood in your hands. You are literally not only aiding a genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, but most of them are children, and that those children will never forgive you. You know, these children are becoming, you know, orphans. They're either being killed, they're either, you know, but even if we think there is an immediate ceasefire, which you have as a president, you have such a responsibility as a world leader and a leader, you know, not only a world leader, but also the president of one of the, you know, the strongest most powerful countries in the world. You have a responsibility, you know, with all of your freedom of speech things and your all the rights and how you talk about democracy. As a democracy, you claim you're a democracy. How are you aiding a genocide of innocent Palestinian children? You know, even if you call for a ceasefire, which you've been objecting and you've been vetoing a ceasefire for Palestinians in Gaza, you know, even if there is a ceasefire, these children, their lives, you know, it's scarred forever. And I'm one of those children. I was once a child. I've lived through these things. I've lost so many people from my family. I didn't even see my family for 6 years, even when I left Gaza. It's not like this is a new situation, you know. All of these lives, all of these dreams, you're responsible for them. For these things, you know, you're doing exactly what Israel is doing, you know.
Yara, thank you so much for your time. This was a most depressing conversation, but thanks so much to our...
Welcome back. And that was a report on the impact on children of the siege on Gaza. That's going to conclude our program for today. If you'd like to have access to this program, all you need to do is go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We're going to close out our program with the legendary jazz artist, Jackie McLean. This is from a 1966 album entitled Dr. Jackal. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.